Hello, I'm Paul Lay, editor of History Today. In the first of our new series of regular podcasts, Eugene Rogan, lecturer in the modern history of the Middle East at the University of Oxford and author of The Arabs, a History, discusses the current revolutions in the Middle East with Martin Evans, professor of history at the University of Portsmouth and the author of Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed.
Right, Eugene, we're seeing remarkable events in the Arab world. For you as a historian of the Arab world, how does a historical perspective help us to understand these events? And then as a historian, how significant do you think these events are within Arab history?
I think 2011 goes down as one of those critical turning points in modern Arab history. I think it's a year of revolutions, and I think it's going to bring substantive change to the way the Arab peoples and their governments get on with each other. So change started in Tunisia and Egypt. How appropriate. If you go back to the 19th century and we're looking for where the centers of reform in the Arab world were, it was Tunisia and Egypt that were leading the way. And so I think their history really does have a lot to tell us about the events today.
Right. And how would you, as a historian, trying to explain the roots of what we're seeing in the Arab world at the moment, how would you attempt to explain it?
I think the broadest point of comparison is we have seen, depending on the country, 40, 50, 60 years of autocratic government go unchallenged by its people. I think in each case, these were governments that came to power with a lot of high hopes invested, you know, by citizens in their governments. But as the years wore on, each of these governments grew increasingly entrenched, less responsive to the needs of their people, and increasingly corrupt. And I think things finally reached a breaking point as populations grew very large, the median age very young, the level of education very high, and I think that, you know, living under autocracy was less and less supportable. So the system's breaking down.
And would you, as a historian, would you actually use the word revolution to describe what is happening at the moment?
I think what we see in Tunisia and Egypt are certainly revolutions in progress. I don't think it's enough to say that bringing down Ben Ali or Mubarak constitutes in itself a revolution. The work in both Tunisia and Egypt remains to be done, which is to take the gains of toppling a government and then consolidate it by constitutional reform, by breaking the power of the official party of state, and by opening the political arena and taking the fear out of politics. You know, close the political prisons, allow people to meet and exchange views freely, enjoy the dignities that people around the world have come to associate with free and open political societies.
So, since a historian, what sort of revolution do you think it is? I mean, some people have talked about it being an Arab 1989. Do you think it's true to say that?
I can see the parallels, and I think the people in the Arab world have compared themselves. The Tunisians were quick to declare themselves the Poland or the Gdansk of the Arab world. They saw the role that they were playing as somehow breaking through a barrier of what was politically imaginable. Suddenly, their movement had achieved the impossible. They had displaced a long-standing autocrat. If they could do it, why couldn't others? And so in this way, you'll have a chain reaction affecting a whole region the way that the events of 1989 affected Eastern Europe.
As a historian, would there be other analogies that you'd make, not just 1989? What would be the other historical parallels that you would perhaps look towards?
Well, interestingly enough, people keep asking if it's inappropriate to talk about Arabs in a collective way. And I think that people in the Arab world do pay more attention to what goes on in other parts of the Arab world than they do with any other part of the world. So in a sense, though the Tunisians might talk about Gdansk, in a way that they're probably looking back to their own era of revolutionary ferment in the 1950s and 60s as the closest examples, then against corrupt regimes too closely linked to imperialism, monarchies, trying to bring in technocrats and modernists and modernizers in a very secular age. They might also be thinking about the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution and the way the 1980s really saw the rise of Islamic forces to power. So there are a host of revolutions that are closer to their own experience than what went on in Eastern Europe after 1989. But they're global citizens now. I think they look at the whole package.
Okay. And what do you think, in terms of the events that we've seen in Egypt and Tunisia, What do you see as historical? What are the new factors that are at play here?
Clearly, the use of social networking software is key to explaining the success of movements in both Tunisia and Egypt, as it was key in organizing Iranians 2 years ago when they opposed the rigged elections that brought Ahmadinejad his second term. In most of the countries in the region, the regimes have imposed very strict limits on freedom of assembly. And Facebook allows a broad community of people to gather beyond the restrictions of the secret police, to exchange views openly, and to organize common action. I don't think the demonstrations in Tunisia or in Egypt would have taken off the same way if you didn't have that medium for people to talk to each other and plan things.
So how do you think the Arab world has changed or been transformed in the last 10 years? As a historian, what would you identify as being the key factors or the key issues?
I come back to the points I raised earlier. I think that when you look at the Arab world, you're seeing a very young, increasingly well-educated and ambitious population. They're looking for jobs that will meet their aspirations. They'd like housing. They'd like to be able to get married and have families. And these are the kinds of milestones that give you a stake in your society. They give you a stake in the future. And it's precisely what, in the last 10 years, young men and women across the Arab world are finding denied them. At the same time, they're looking at a growing inequality in their societies, where a very thin layer is growing increasingly wealthy, usually in proximity to the ruling elites, while the vast majority of the population is getting poorer and poorer. And I think that growing inequality has been a real plague across the Arab world, forcing the region to a kind of breaking point over the past 10 years. And I think the third thing, if we could look into a sort of global scenario, is that in many ways, the decade since 9/11/2001 has put the region under more pressure than ever before. External pressure, as the war on terror has led to the United States and its allies making wars in Iraq, Afghanistan. They've been threatening regime change in Syria and Iran. They've been using drone missile strikes in Yemen and Pakistan. And at the same time, their own governments have used the war on terror as a pretext to clamp down on citizens like never before, with arrests without charge, extrajudicial killings, torture. So I think we've seen the worst decade in modern Arab history since 2001. And in a sense, the revolutions of 2011 are the lid blowing off a whole region put under far too much pressure by both the outside world and their own government.
And as a historian, what do you think are the political ideas that are motivating these protests?
In both Tunisia and Egypt, we have seen very large umbrella organizations bringing in Islamists and secularists, the left and the right. It's a rather acephalous movement, and maybe that's its strength. You can't decapitate a movement without a visible head. But at the same time, in trying to bring the nation together to stand as one against the oppressive regime, you're really bringing in so many different political trends that I think it defies a generalization. I think at this point you're really seeing everyone clubbing together under the same wish for an open political arena. And then I think once those rules are established, the gloves will come off and you'll see the kind of dirty politics we associate with democracy of intense competition and rivalry and where the differences between the parties will come out. But at the moment, they're all more or less united against a common objective.
Many commentators are making an analogy with the Iranian Revolution and the idea that, in a sense, lurking the shadows behind all of this is the spectre of political Islam, of Islamism. What do you think, as a historian, how important has Islamism been within these demonstrations?
It is very clear that Islamic parties in Tunisia and Egypt did not instigate these movements, and that they have been playing catch-up ever since. This doesn't mean they've been entirely absent. Pious Muslims and members of banned Islamist organizations have certainly been in the crowd, but I think observers have been really struck to see how many of the women in demonstrations didn't wear a headscarf, how many of the men were clean-shaven. So you're not seeing the kind of beards and clothing associated with the Islamist movement. To me, it seems to reflect a way in which historians and analysts have been preoccupied with Islamic politics and neglected the very vital role that secular forces continue to play in Arab societies. So I think one of the things that will be most subject to revision after 2011 will be the relative weight of secular politics versus religious politics. I think that perhaps we've had that out of balance.
Do you think then it's possible to talk about a post-Islamist generation that is articulating political demands at the moment?
I think it would be too soon to declare anything post-Islamist. I think getting the balance right between the relative weight of Islamic and secular forces is what's going to be the challenge in Egypt and Tunisia, as for us who study these places.
And as a historian, how do you think the events of the last 2 months, how do you think they have transformed the Arab world?
The year 2011 began with such dramatic reversals of fortune for deeply entrenched governments that clearly no head of state in the Arab world can rest easy. They know that they are under scrutiny by their citizens as never before. And I use the word citizens, where in the past we might have thought more of subjects, of people who had to obey the diktats of their governments. There was one banner in Tahrir Square which said, "People shouldn't fear their governments, governments should fear the people." And I think that is the most monumentous change of 2011. I think governments are genuinely nervous in Yemen, in Sudan, in Palestine, in Algeria, in Syria, in Jordan, in Bahrain. And those are only the places where we've already seen manifestation of citizen rage against failed governments. I think every regime across the region faces the same fear. And I think whether they respond by concessions to try and forestall the revolution at home, so whether we get an evolution towards political freedom, or whether we see more autocrats being overthrown by popular movements through revolutions, I think the region is going to go through a fundamental transformation.
And as a historian, where do you think this is going to lead?
Revolutions always lead to disorder. And so, though we're living in February 2011, a moment of optimism and enthusiasm, seeing citizens achieving their demands and overthrowing deeply entrenched autocrats, that's very exciting. But the hard work remains to be done, of trying to revise constitutions, of entering into a meaningful political process where a plurality of voices will compete and be respected and allowed to play by the same sets of rules, where the role of the military remains very much in question. Heaven knows, the military has played such a dangerous influence in regional politics since the 1950s. And to try and move beyond military regimes to truly civilian government is a challenge that they'll have to overcome. And in the process, there may very well be forces that try to subvert the democratic shift, to try and reassert the prerogatives of old regimes. So the hard work remains to be done after 2 or 3 weeks of popular protests bringing down dictators. And it's too soon to tell. To borrow Chou En-lai's response to Henry Kissinger, certainly for the revolutions in the Arab world, like the French Revolution, it's just too soon to tell.
Okay, thank you very much, Eugene Rogan.
Thank you so much.